In the last couple of lessons, we've been looking at the Antichrist, the times of the Antichrist. They're recorded in Revelation chapter 13. We looked in the Old Testament prophets, Daniel particularly, looking at how he initially comes on the scene, the tactics that he uses. We know that it tells us that a vile person will arise, but with only a small number of followers at first, and he'll come in peaceably. And it says he seizes the kingdom by intrigue. He acts deceitfully and devises plans, but just for a time. The initial thing is going to be hidden, what he really has in mind. We know that he's going to initially make a covenant or a treaty with the people of Israel, with many in Israel, it says in Daniel chapter 9. It is a seven-year covenant. It is the final week of Daniel's 70th 7 in Daniel chapter 9. And he will allow them to worship in their temple and bring their sacrifices and their offerings and continue their religion. And so that's how he'll come on the scene and probably establish himself with the people of Israel, is by making that treaty. The turning point is what we saw in Revelation chapter 12, where Satan is cast out of heaven. Michael the archangel and his angels fight against the devil and his angels, and Michael prevails, and the devil and his angels are cast out of heaven to the earth. And this is great joy to those in heaven. This is great woe to those who live upon the earth, in particular the people of Israel, God's people Israel, earthly people. Well, it says he is going to he knows that he only has a short time left, because that turning point takes place in the middle of that 70th 7. So after 3.5 years, this is when this takes place. And so he will persecute the woman, Israel, and try to destroy her and try to destroy the remnant of Israel that is there. And so that's what we're reading about in Revelation chapter 13, is when things have turned and we see destruction coming from Satan, that is the dragon, and it comes through his man, the Antichrist. We looked last time at the terrible form that the Antichrist will take at that point in time. Things will change when Satan's cast to the earth. Things will change drastically with the Antichrist himself. Look at chapter 13, verse 2. It says at the end of that verse, it says, "The dragon gives him power and his throne and great authority." So this is definitely Satan's man is who this is, and it's going to become very evident in that last 3.5 years. What happens in verse 3 is, "I saw one of his heads as if it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world marveled and followed the beast." This basically appears that the Antichrist is killed and that he is resurrected, basically copying what happened to the Lord Jesus Christ, because he's going to present himself as the Christ. And so when this happens to him, the world marvels and follows after the beast. And the world worships the beast, and they worship the dragon who gives him his power and authority. We see in the first few verses of this chapter is this beast with 7 heads and 10 horns. And I think if you take all of this together, you see the final stage of the Gentile empire over Israel and over Jerusalem. And we saw that beginning with Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon in 606 B.C. This would be the final stage of it, the final kingdom that's represented by the feet and the toes of that image in Daniel chapter 2. And the last beast, the terrible, strange beast, and the little horn that rises up in those last days. But go into chapter 17 just real quick. I'm trying to hit this kind of quickly. I don't want to go too much time on it. But look with me in verse 8. We looked at these verses. It says, "The beast that you saw was and is not and will ascend out of the bottomless pit and go to perdition. And those who dwell on the earth will marvel, whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they see the beast that was and is not and yet is." Now, it says this 3 times in this passage, so that's a real important idea here. The beast existed, and then he didn't exist, and then he existed again. Well, what happens? I think this is reference to him receiving that mortal wound, or appearing to at least, and then being resurrected, or appearing to. But notice verse 10, well, verse 9. "Here is the mind which has wisdom. The 7 heads are 7 mountains, or recommend 7 mountains or 7 kingdoms, on which the woman, Babylon, sits. There are also 7 kings. These are 7 mountains, or kingdoms, have 7 kings. 5 have fallen. 1 is. And the other is not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short time. Then the beast that was and is not is himself also the 8th." So he's the 7th, but he's also the 8th. He's of the 7, and he's going to perdition. Notice the statement back in verse 8. "He will ascend out of the bottomless pit." I think the 7th king the final king that's described there, will reign initially in a mortal form. I think when Satan is cast out of heaven, he'll receive a deadly wound and he'll be healed. And when he's resurrected or appears to be resurrected, he will ascend in demonic form out of the bottomless pit. And that's who will be reigning on the earth during that last 3.5 years. And that's when the terror will come upon the people of Israel and upon the whole world, for that matter. This is the final Gentile empire. Look at verse 12. He says, "The 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings. Compare that with the 10 toes that you see in the image in Daniel 2. He says, "Who have not received a king, who have received no kingdom as yet, they receive authority for 1 hour or for a short time as kings with the beast. They are of one mind. They will give their power and authority to the beast." Verse 14, "These will make war with the Lamb. The Lamb will overcome them, for He is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with Him are called chosen and faithful." And we just gave away the end of the story right there in verse 14. That's what's going to happen. That will happen at the close of that 7-year period, the last 3.5 years. So this is the final Gentile empire, the final kingdom of the times of the Gentiles. Now, go back with me to chapter 13. Let's pick up where we left off last time. And look with me at verse... We're going to look now at his treachery, because one of the first things he'll do is any agreements, any covenants, anything that he said in the past, we'll find out now, is all a lie. Even his allowing Israel to worship their God and allowing them to bring their sacrifices and offerings and come to the temple and so forth, all of that's going to come to an end. And we're going to see that this beast is a beast that is blasphemous in his nature. He will, in this last 3.5-year period, speak against God. He will revile God. And not only will he revile God, but he'll also make claims to be God. Both of those would have been something that would have been considered blasphemy by the Jews. And both of them are blasphemy. Verse 1 of this 13th chapter, he says, I stood on the sand of the sea and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea. And the last thing it says there in verse 1 is, this, and on his heads was a blasphemous name. And again, that indicates what he's going to do. He will call himself by a name, which basically is blasphemy against God. Look at verse 5. After he is supposedly healed of this deadly wound, look at verse 4. They worshiped the dragon who gave authority to the beast. They worshiped the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with him?" And then in verse 5, and he was given a mouth speaking great things. And the word great means, in a sense, pompous words. Okay, words to exalt himself or make himself look great. And he's giving a mouth speaking great things, but also and blasphemies. He's speaking against God, blasphemous things against God. Notice he goes on, he says, he was given authority to continue for 42 months. Again, this is the last 3.5 years of the tribulation period. This is when he will reign in this way. Verse 6, he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God. And it gives us a list of all the things that he particularly speaks against. He blasphemes God's name. I don't know if that's the name of Elohim or Jehovah, but he blasphemes that name. Even the name, you know, the word God and can be translated several ways. But he's going to blaspheme God's name. He's going to blaspheme God's tabernacle. That is his dwelling place. Where does God dwell? That's probably a reference to the temple. I think is what he's talking about there. He will blaspheme, it says, those who dwell in heaven. I don't know if that has reference to God's angels, are those creatures that surround the throne, those angelic creatures that surround the throne, or whether it has reference to the saints who are in heaven. But he will blaspheme all of those probably as well. And so here is the first thing we see about him is he turns in basically a revolt against God, a total reviling of God in order to set up his claims to be God. In Daniel chapter 7, verse 25. We won't turn to all of these because we've looked at some of them before. It says, he speaks pompous words against the Most High. Pompous words against the Most High. Daniel 11:36, he will exalt and magnify himself above every god, whether it's a Hindu god or whether it's the god of the Muslims, whoever it is. And he says, and he will speak blasphemies against the God of gods. And that is the one true God of glory, Jehovah. So blasphemy is the first thing you'll see about him. Then we see indignation. He is angry. He will display a tremendous anger. And the anger certainly is against God, but particularly it'll be seen against God's people. But it starts by being his indignation and his anger against the covenant. The covenant that he himself made with Israel, the 7-year covenant, he will basically defy that covenant and stand against that covenant. I was wanting to look at something. I want you to look at something with me just to show what he'll do. Go with me to Daniel chapter 11. Daniel chapter 11 is a fascinating chapter. It describes, in the first part of it, it describes, let me just back up just a second because this is a good picture of these things. At the end of Alexander the Great's life, he had conquered the world, and he died very early age, and he had four generals. And even the scriptures give prophecy of this. In Daniel chapter 8, you see this. His kingdom was divided up among four generals. Okay, one of them was Egypt, one of them was in Syria. I forgot where all of them were, but the two main ones we'll look at, one in Egypt and one in Syria. The one in Syria was a man named Antiochus Epiphanes, which means the giver of light, or light coming upon him, or something like that. That's what he called himself. The people called him Antiochus Epiphanes, which means the mad one. Because he was crazy in one sense, he was angry in another sense. And he made several attempts to invade Egypt. He wanted to conquer the general, and you know, this is not the general himself, this is a descendant of the general from several years. But he wanted to conquer the Egyptian king and so forth. So we went down there and he failed. And when he came back, he has, you know, think about Syria and Egypt. What's in between? Israel, people of Israel in between. And again, he's an angry man, and so when he comes back, he takes out his anger on the people of Israel. He has control over them. They're under Syrian rule and so forth. He goes down again 2 years later, and this is 168 B.C. is the time of the frame this takes place. He invades Egypt again the second time. It talks about it in Daniel chapter 11 as he goes toward the south, okay? And that's where he's going against Egypt. But this invasion didn't even get as far as the first one. He failed in the first one because he himself could not defeat the armies of the Egyptians. This time, when he gets there, there are some ships that are there. There's a contingent from Rome there that basically tells him, no, turn around and go home. You're not going to invade Egypt. And he'd like to dispute that, but Rome is already growing in power. You know, the Grecian Empire was already divided into four parts, so it's not very strong. Rome was about to conquer the world, and so Romans basically tell him, you go back home. And so he does. Where does he go through? He goes through the land of Israel. Look with me in Daniel chapter 11. Just look briefly. I want you to notice a couple things that he does. Now, Daniel chapter 11 is a prophecy with a double meaning. And a lot of the Old Testament prophecies are this way. They have a near-term fulfillment of the prophecy that we see, but it also is a picture of something that has an ultimate fulfillment that's still in the future. And I think that's what we see in this particular case. Look with me at verse 29. And this is talking about Antiochus. And amazing, these prophecies were given hundreds of years before this took place. Okay. He says, at the appointed time, he, and this is Antiochus, he shall return and go toward the south, toward Egypt. But it shall not be like the former or the latter, for ships from Cyprus shall come against him. And again, that was the Roman contingent sailed down from Cyprus in these ships to Egypt. Therefore he shall be grieved, and he shall return in rage against what? Against the Holy Covenant. Now that's the covenant that he made with the people of Israel when he came to power and so forth. He says, and he shall do damage. So he shall return and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. Those Jews who are willing to forsake the covenant and follow him. What he was trying to do, he was trying to establish, basically he was trying to Hellenize Israel. They turn it into a Greek, sovereignly controlled area. And so one of the things he wanted to do was make sure that they worship Greek gods rather than worship their own God. And so anybody who was willing to do that, he would basically treat them and show them great regard. Verse 31, forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress, that's the temple, and they shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation. Now what he did was this. He was angry with the whole situation. He took it out on Israel. He attacked Israel or Jerusalem. He attacked Jerusalem on the Sabbath day, which means that made it very difficult for Israel to do anything because they had so many restrictions on what they could do. He only had 22,000 soldiers, and they were supposed to be on a peace mission. That's what they supposedly came through for, and that's what the message was sent out for. But think about that scripture. It talks about when they say peace and safety, what comes next? Sudden destruction. And that's exactly what he brought upon the people of Jerusalem. He killed over 100,000 people in Jerusalem on those days. He took the women and children as slaves. He burned large sections of the city. He burned copies of the law. And he basically took away the daily sacrifice and says, you cannot worship your God in your temple any longer. You cannot celebrate your feast. You're not supposed to circumcise your children. Anybody who circumcised their children in defiance of his laws and so forth was put to death. And there were several women, who did that. And then he set up the abomination of desolation. That's what the Jews called it. What he did was he sacrificed a swine on the altar. The altar that was out there that they're supposed to sacrifice animals and so forth. What was the swine considered? That was the most unclean of all the animals you could imagine in Israel. He sacrificed that on their altar. He took the juice from this animal and he spread it over all the various articles and pieces of furniture, if you want to call them that, the furnishings of the temple. That was an abomination in the eyes of God. Therefore, is that which makes desolate. He told them, you either worship Zeus or you die. That's what they were commanded. And look at verse 32. Those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery. But the people who know their God shall be strong, and they shall carry out great exploits. That was exactly what Antiochus did back in 168 BC. But can you see how that's a picture of exactly what the Antichrist is going to do in the future? He is a picture of the Antichrist. In fact, as you go farther in this chapter, particularly down to verse 36 through the end of the chapter in chapter 11, it seems to turn for sure and say, this is more than just Antiochus. This is the Antichrist. This is the future. This takes us to the time of the end. And so that's what we're going to find that the Antichrist is going to do during this this last 3.5 years of the tribulation period. Go back with me to Revelation chapter 13. So he's angry against the covenant, and he returns in rage, he does damage and so forth, and Daniel 9:27, in the midst of the final week of that 70 weeks prophecy, he breaks the covenant. Two things it says he does. He takes away the daily sacrifices, he stops Israel from worshiping anymore in their temple, and he sets up the abomination of desolation in the Holy of Holies. Let's look at Daniel 9 for a second. Let's turn back there. I'm sorry. Put something in Daniel and something in Revelation. Anytime you study either book, you probably have to do that. Daniel chapter 9. This is the 70 weeks prophecy. I want you to notice verse 27 and what he says in there. Daniel 9:27. It says, "Then he," this is the prince who is to come, okay? Not the Messiah, the prince, but the prince who is to come. "He shall confirm a covenant with many," that's in Israel, "for 1 week," or 1 7. "But in the middle of the week, he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering." Now look at the next statement. "And on the wing of abominations shall be one who makes desolate, even until the consummation, which is determined, is poured out on the desolate." Now let's look at this verse just a little bit closer. He says, "On the wing of abominations shall be one who makes desolate." The word "wing" there carries the idea of an extremity, okay? So it's the farthest part, the corners, or the farthest, or the ends of something. What he's saying, I think, is the wings of abomination is the ultimate abomination in the eyes of God. What is the ultimate abomination in the eyes of God? And that would be to defile His temple, which is His dwelling place upon the earth. It is an abomination. The word means that which is disgusting, that which is filthy, that which is detestable, that which is something God hates. And it makes desolate. It lays waste. It devastates. It empties. In particular, it empties of God's presence. And that's what's going to happen in those days. God cannot dwell in the temple any longer because of what has been placed there that's an abomination in His eyes. This will stay there, evidently, it says, even until the consummation. The consummation is the final wrapping up of everything, when God consummates His eternal plan and purpose. In particular, His consummation for what He plans for this man, Satan's man, the Antichrist. He says, until the consummation, which is determined, appointed by God, He says, is poured out on the desolate. And some believe that that should be translated the desolator, the one who desolates. So it would be poured out upon the Antichrist and upon His kingdom. I think it's probably a reference to the bowls of wrath. The last seven judgments are seven shallow bowls of God's wrath that are going to be poured out on the earth, in particular upon the Antichrist of the beast and upon his kingdom. So all of this is going to stay in place until basically we get to the time of the end. The seven bowls will be poured out at the very end before Jesus Christ comes back. Look at chapter 8 for just a second. Daniel chapter 8. And go down with me to verse 9. And again, this is another one of those that has, this is a double prophecy. This is, has near-term and ultimate fulfillment. This is talking about Antiochus, I think in one sense, but ultimately the Antichrist. Starting in verse 9, he says, "And one of them," he says, "out of one of them came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south and toward the east and toward the glorious land." What do you think the glorious land is? Now, I think that's probably Israel's promised land. That's glorious because that's where God, that's the land God promised Israel. That's the land where God dwelt in the midst of His people. So this is Antiochus growing strong toward the south, coming in and taking Jerusalem, and certainly making overtures to go all the way down to Egypt, although that doesn't work out for him. He says, "And it grew up to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host and some of the stars to the ground, and he trampled them. He even exalted himself as high as the prince of the host." Now, that could, some believe that's a reference to the priests of Israel. So basically exalting himself to be higher than Israel's high priest. I think it goes even higher than that because it uses the word prince. I think the prince points to Israel's ultimate prince, the Lord Jesus Christ. He exalted himself as high as the prince of the host, Christ. "And by him," by this man, "the daily sacrifices were taken away, and the place of his," that is God's sanctuary, "was cast down. Because of transgression, an army was given over to the horn to oppose the daily sacrifices, and he cast truth down to the ground, and he did all this," and what does it say about him? "And he prospered." He was successful in everything he intended to do, everything he did. "Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that certain one who was speaking, 'How long will the vision be concerning the daily sacrifices and the transgression of desolation, the giving of both the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot?'" How long will he trample underfoot this sanctuary, this place of God's dwelling? And verse 14, it says, "And he said to me, 'For 2,300 days, and then the sanctuary shall be cleansed.'" And that's going to take us to the end of the tribulation period that's described there. So this is what he's doing. This is the ultimate transgression against God, is idolatry, and it comes in the form of this beast. It says in we won't look at all of this. Daniel 11:31, it says, "Forces will be mustered by him. He shall defile the sanctuary fortress, take away the daily sacrifice, and place the abomination of desolation." Now, Jesus talked about this. Keep your place in Daniel, but look in Matthew chapter 24. After Jesus had made his triumphant entry into Jerusalem, he pronounced, basically, you know, he pronounced woe upon Jerusalem because they had basically, he said, "How often I wanted to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks or her brood under her wings, but you were not willing. You wouldn't do it." And it says, "Your house is going to be left to you desolate, empty, until you say, 'Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord.'" Then he takes his apostles up on the Mount of Olives, and they begin to ask him questions about the time of the end, the time of his coming, and how long the temple is going to be destroyed. And he tells them how. But in the middle of this, he gives them a warning about something. Look at verse 15, Matthew 24, verse 15. He says to them, "Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand. Then let those who are in Judea do what? Flee to the mountains." When you see this event take place, when you see this prophecy fulfilled, when the abomination of desolation stands in the holy place, and that's the Holy of Holies, okay? That's not just the temple. That is in the Holy of Holies, the place where the Ark of the Covenant was, the place where God would dwell in the midst of His people. He says, "Then you flee." Now, what will it be? Look at 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Paul talks about this. He doesn't talk about these days just too much, but evidently the Thessalonians were confused a lot about the future. He talks in 1 Thessalonians about the rapture. He talks in 2 Thessalonians about the day of the Lord. And so he gives a picture of what's going to happen in the future, the day of the Lord, and what will happen when He comes. Verse 3, 2 Thessalonians 2, he says, "Let no one deceive you by any means, for that day," and I think he's talking about the day of the Lord, "that day of the Lord will not come unless the falling away comes first. And the man of sin is revealed." That's another title for the Antichrist. the son of perdition. There's another title for the Antichrist. Notice what it says about him, verse 4. Who opposes, that's blaspheme is one aspect of blasphemy, is standing in opposition or speaking against. He says he opposes and he exalts himself above all that is called God or all that is worshipped. In other words, any god of any religion, so that he sits as God in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. Now that passage indicates, what is the abomination of desolation? The Antichrist himself. It appears that at some point in time, he's going to set himself right there in that Holy of Holies and declare himself and show himself and tell everybody, I am God. He's going to blaspheme Israel's God, who is the true God, and he's going to claim that he himself is God. When you see that take place, Jesus said, you flee. You get out, because it means something terrible is coming. Go with me to Revelation 13 again. Revelation 13, and look at verse 4. When all of this takes place, the world will follow after it very easily, it seems. And I believe that when I look at what's going on in our world today. I can see the people of the world today following after this very easily. I can see them being susceptible to Satan's lie that comes through the beast. And I can see them following this when, you know, all this time it's such a clear presentation of the Word of God and the truth of God and Jesus Christ being the very God of glory and our Savior. And that they reject, but this they're going to follow so quickly and so easily. You wonder about the delusion that God may send them. But the whole world is going to worship the dragon. They're going to worship the beast. And look at verse 6. He opens his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme those things. Verse 7. It was granted to him to make war with the saints. Now, the saints here would be anybody who is a believer in Jesus Christ. But in particular, the people that's going to be involved in that is going to be the people of Israel primarily. There will be some Gentiles as well, but I think we're mainly dealing with Israel during these last days, and that's who this is really about. He's going to make war with the saints. And what's going to happen? He's given not only authority to make war with them, but to overcome them, to win the victory over them. And authority is given him over every tribe and tongue and nation. That's the whole world. He is a world ruler. He is going to rule over one world government in those days. He will be the one who's in charge. And it says in verse 8, and all who dwell on the earth will worship him. Now, if I stopped right there, it'd sound like everybody's lost. But what does it say? Whose names have not been written in the book of the life of the Lamb from the foundation of the world. In other words, all unbelievers whose names are not in the book of life, they will worship him in those days. You'll be forced to. He will basically force people to submit with his armies and his power and his strength. And it comes from Satan himself. And that's what basically Antiochus tried to do. The Antichrist will actually do that in the future. And so we see this next stage is the terrorism. He makes war against primarily the people of Israel. Back up to chapter 12 for just a second. We see that is Satan's intent all along. And this is how he's going to carry it out through the Antichrist. Verse 13. Revelation 12:13. When the dragon, Satan, saw that he had been cast to the earth, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child. Now, the woman is who? Israel. And the male child? I believe that's Christ. So he's going to persecute Israel. But the woman was given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness to her place. What did Jesus say? When you see it happen, flee. See, all of this happens pretty much at the same time. Satan's cast out of heaven. All these things that, you know, happen, you know, right, very quick succession, I believe. And so she's nourished there for a time and times and half a time. There will be people in Israel who will be out in the wilderness in a place prepared by God where they'll be protected. Think about Israel when they were down in Egypt. And God sent all these plagues upon Egypt. Some of them Israel was affected by, but most of the last plagues, that land of Goshen, where they were dwelling down there, the plagues didn't hit there. I think that's a picture of what's going to take place in the future in the tribulation. God's going to have a place for people prepared to protect them and to feed them there and protect them from the presence of the serpent. Verse 15, so the serpent spewed water out of his mouth like a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away by the flood. But the earth helped the woman. The earth opened its mouth, swallowed up the flood, which the dragon had spewed out of his mouth. And the dragon was enraged. He couldn't get to Israel as much as he wanted to. He was enraged with the woman, so he went to make war with the rest of her offspring. With the ones, it says, who keep the commandments of God and who have or who hold fast to the testimony of Jesus Christ. He's going to go after those who are saints. Saints of the Most High is what it says in Daniel chapter 7. And he will prevail. And then there will be thousands and thousands of them killed, just like Antiochus killed all those Jews on that Sabbath day there in Jerusalem. The Antichrist is going to do the same thing. He's going to kill them. Look at one other verse, though. Go back with me to verse 10. Same chapter, chapter 12, verse 10. When Satan is cast out, it says, John says, I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, now was Satan cast out, salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ have come, for the accuser of our brethren, who accused them before our God day and night, he has been cast down. That's the word devil. That's what the word devil means, is the false accuser, the slanderer, okay? Verse 11, and they overcame him. Wait a minute. 13, what does it say? He overcame them. How? He's going to kill most of them. You know, well, the ones who don't escape and flee into the wilderness and find protection there are going to be killed. They're going to be killed because they maintain their testimony of Jesus Christ and they maintain their keeping of the commandments of God. They're going to overcome. Now, in what way? They overcame him by the blood of the Lamb. Doesn't mean that they overcame physically and they won the victory physically. They overcame spiritually by the blood of the Lamb, because that blood of the Lamb took care of their sins completely. Their sins were completely forgiven and they trusted in that blood. They overcame by the word of their testimony, by the fact that they maintained a testimony for Jesus Christ even in the face of what Satan and his man are doing. And they did not love their lives unto the death. Revelation chapters 2 and 3, the messages that are given to the seven churches who will be here during that future time, every message ends with what? To him who overcomes. Him who endures to the end. These overcome because they trust in the blood of the Lamb, because they maintain and keep the commandments of God, they keep the word and hold to the word of their testimony, and they don't love their lives physically, even to the point that they're willing to die. And that's what you have to do during that period. So he's going to think he's getting the victory because he kills these thousands and thousands of Jews. He's going to think he's getting the victory because it seems like the whole world is worshiping him. He's in charge. He's in control. He controls everything. Go back to chapter 13. Look at verse 9. These overcome. These who are killed overcome, because notice what it says in verse 9. If anyone has an ear, let him do what? Hear. Because faith comes out of hearing, and hearing through the word of God. That's what they have, is they have faith. They have faith. He who leads into captivity, and that is exactly what the Antichrist will do. He will take captive many. He will kill many. He who leads into captivity, what's going to happen to him? He shall go into captivity. He who kills with the sword, and he will do that, he'll kill hundreds of thousands probably during those days. What's going to happen to him? He must be killed with the sword as well. Here is the patience and the faith of the saints. The word patience means patient endurance. Here are the saints who will patiently endure through this whole thing, never fall down and worship the beast, never take his mark or his image in any way, and they're the ones that are going to overcome because they love not their lives unto the death. You know, when Jesus talked to his disciples, he told them to flee, because it says in Matthew 24, because then there will be great tribulation in the earth. Tribulation such as Israel has never seen or ever will see again. It's the worst thing that will ever happen. I think about some of the things that have happened in Israel's past. They've had a lot of periods throughout history in which they've had some terrible things happen to me. I've been watching some shows about the World War II. And, you know, when the soldiers first discovered the concentration camps, and it was unnerving to watch that, even though it's just actors portraying it, to think what those Jews went through in those days. And yet, as bad as it was under Hitler, he says, under the Antichrist, he says, it's going to be so much worse. That gives us a good measuring point. It's going to be much worse than it was in the days of Hitler. So there's going to be great tribulation. Jeremiah refers to it as the time of Jacob's trouble. And he compares the pain that they're going to go through to the pain of a woman going through childbirth. Now, men can't really identify with that, but women, I guess, certainly can identify with that, that have been mothers. They know how much that pain is. It's going to be that type of level of pain that they're going to go through, because it is a time that is basically the birth pangs that Israel as a nation will go through before that nation is one day going to be reborn. We're going to finish up in Daniel chapter 11, last passage. Daniel chapter 11. We read one of these verses. We're going to look at it again. I want to look at the last part. As bad as it is for believers in those days, and again, hundreds of thousands of them will be killed, there's a strength that these believers have as well. There is a perseverance that they have, that they will be able to make a difference in people's lives, just as believers today, we're supposed to make a difference in people's lives by our testimony. But look at verse 32. Daniel 11, it says, those who do wickedly against the covenant, it says, he shall corrupt with flattery. So those who align themselves with the Antichrist and oppose the covenant along with him, he says, he's going to basically corrupt them with flattery and so forth and encourage them and promise them all sorts of things, and so they'll go along with them. But the people who know their God shall be what? Strong. The people who know their God shall be strong, and they shall carry out great exploits. They'll do wonderful things, even in the midst of this terrible trouble that they're going through, this terrorism that he unleashes against them. Verse 33, and those of the people who understand shall instruct many. God's still going to have those who are his children, his saints, during that time. They're still going to work for the Lord. They're still going to serve the Lord. They're still going to bear testimony for the Lord. They're going to instruct many. They're going to tell people and help people understand, listen, you've got to stay strong. You've got to persevere. You've got to overcome. You've got to be willing to give up your life in order to save it. You know, Jesus pretty much said the same thing in his earthly ministry. He who loses his life, he who loves his life, you know, can lose it. And he who is willing to give up his life can gain it. Well, he's talking about two different things. Those who are willing to give up their physical life will gain spiritual life. Those who are not. Those who their physical life and their possessions and their comfort means more to them than anything else, they're giving up their spiritual life. And so he says, these will instruct many, it says. And yet, he says, for many days they shall fall by sword and flame, by captivity and by plundering. And when they fall, they shall be aided with a little help, but many shall join with them by intrigue. And some of those of understanding shall fall to refine them, to purify them, to make them white until the time of the end, because it's still for the appointed time. We talked about this, I think, last time. In Zechariah chapter 13, he says, you know, God's going to bring, you know, one-third of the people through the fire. Two-thirds are going to be purged out of Israel. But one-third is going to be brought through that fire. And those who live through that and endure through that, they're going to be, those are going to be the ones who constitute the true Israel. The Israel of God, and they will be saved. And we see that when we get to the second coming of Christ. Next time, we're going to move on in chapter 13 and look at the second beast that is described here. The first beast rises up out of the sea. The second beast rises up out of the earth. We'll look beginning in verse 11 through verse 18. And this beast is identified as the false prophet. We're going to talk about the nature of the false prophet. What does he do? What purpose does he serve? What is he able to do? What are the things that what is he able to do? What is he not able to do? We'll look at that question as well and continue this study next time, the Lord willing. Okay, let's close in prayer tonight.